Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. I'm Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy. And as always, here with Richard Hill, Managing Editor. Howdy, Richard.
Howdy, Matt. And I'm managing quite well. Because we've actually got we've got a brother in earnest, Rossi, coming and chatting. So it was very exciting. Tell me a little about who we're talking to today.
We're going to be talking to Stephen Hoskinson, and he is the founder and chief compassion officer of Organic Intelligence. And Stephen has been trained in somatics, mindfulness. He's done research in clinical psychology, and he's adjunct faculty at John F. Kennedy University Somatic Psychology Program. And as you will find out, he is a very clever fellow.
Yes, and very interesting. And he's got a bunch of programs and things which we'll talk about, and they're really useful. But I just love this term, organic intelligence. There's something sort of systemic and all that stuff. So I think we're going to go and check out what he's got to say. Huh?
Let's go find out. So, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be a part of the other hemisphere.
Yes, and hi from me. It's Richard here. Nice to see you, Steve.
Great to see you as well.
Now, Steve, I thought we might be able to just kick off on a very popular topic for Richard and I, and our listeners will be very familiar that this is something that we're on and on about all the time, and that's nonlinear complex systems and why thinking in those terms is important for psychotherapy, well, for we think for anybody. And
because it's the way things work, it is helpful to have models of that map pretty well onto how reality is.
And so we do come from being schooled very much so in a linear way of thinking. So I just wanted to sort of explore, you know, your journey in discovering the importance of complex systems and how you've applied that in your own work.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Thank you for the invitation. You know, it's such a nearly esoteric language. It may as well be theology, you know, and so I'm just really grateful that y'all are supporting this exploration. For me, the exploration really was through graduate school in clinical psychology, because I began really, you know, quite orthodox in the psychodynamic perspective, and then rapidly began to shift into a systems perspective as I began to work with children and families, and really working then within a family systems approach. And that family systems approach then led me into the encounter with the world of Milton Erickson and altered states and the mind-body connection. And so my master's thesis at the time then was... hypnosis increases salivary immunoglobulin A, right?
Of course it does.
And it actually ended up being very helpful because I found that people who read that were often cured of insomnia. You just read that master's degree and woo, and a good night's sleep is on its way.
Although, just not letting you go too far down there, the importance of these things and the shifts in the biochemistry is really important. So, although we're joking, it's even these minor shifts are really exciting to differentiate and explore. You know, wake yourself up every now and again to get back into it, but I'm sure it'd be fascinating.
Well, right, and just the way that we understand from complexity science, understanding that most shifts, and you know, really, you look back to the whole notion of paradigm shift and the notion that most changes are happening very incrementally, and then boom, there is a chaotic phase shift, and the whole quality of a system changes like that. You know, these seemingly miraculous changes, or something dramatically different happens, and healing, you know, happens, or quantum healing, sometimes people call it. And it really is confusing for people, because most of the time we're plodding along incrementally, and then there is this recognition that these chaotic phase shifts happen at certain moments, and these catastrophic like shifts happen. And it's available in the language, you know. We say the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, it's popularly aware, but then to be able to map that into, you know, complexity motifs helps refine our sense of change. You know, we're sitting in with a client and change, we're plodding along. It seems like two steps forward, two steps back, two steps forward. And then something gets traction and then everything changes. And so to be able to have some sense of mapping and even predictive ability around when and how those changes happen can be, I think, really a powerful tool. So I begin to understand and work with people from that standpoint of complexity as I began to study more the work of Milton Erickson. And in that master's thesis also, I consulted with Ernest Rossi, who was just so generous with his time. And then really pointing, I mean, he was so ahead of his time, you know, in really looking at ultradian rhythms, circadian rhythms, biological rhythms, and the nature of biological synchrony really is what we began to look at. And organic intelligence is really founded in that understanding of how we are an organism precisely because our systems are organizing. And you know, you think of respiratory sinus arrhythmia, right? The way that we breathe in, heart rate goes up, breathe out, heart rate goes down, these baroreceptors in the chest providing this feedback. And the systems perspective, I think, is so key. Even if we don't get to, you know, complexity and the various, you know, phases of understanding phase transition and critical periods and so on, just understanding that there is a vast and whirring interaction that is our biology, I think, is appropriately humbling. You know, we wouldn't think to, you know, in the midst of a concert or a symphony, walking up to the conductor and go, "Hey, look, give me a turn with a stick. You know, let me do the conducting a little bit." You know, but we have no compunction about futzing around with our neurobiology. You know, it's like, "Oh, let's open up the hood on the Ferrari and let's tinker around a little bit. Never worked on one before. Let's see what happens if you pull this out. You know, that'll probably help."
I'd just like to grab you and slow us down and reverse us a little bit, because there are a few things that popped in there. One particularly is this term that you've utilized, this organic intelligence, which is lovely. And in the context of complex systems, now I'm sure that when I ask you the question, you'll go off in a different direction to what people are expecting. And of course, well, you know, of course, my connection with Ernest Rossi is we're a little bit like a pinky finger connected. And we just describe it as, or utilize that same frame of thinking as naturalness. And that loss of naturalness. And one of the key things I put in the very beginning of my book was that people come in and say, "I'm not okay," in 50 different ways, 500 different ways. Then we do some stuff with them and they say, "I am okay." And so I posed in the book, what we never ask is the really important question is, how do they know? And this, I think, is is what I'm getting from this sense of organic intelligence. It's not that an intelligence that controls things, but it's an intelligence that ... open-ended sentence. Leave it now to you, Steve. What is the framework behind that idea that you've utilized as a terminology for your work?
Well, I think it really begs this question. You know, we are healing in every way. You know, we are processing, we are relating to the environment and into complex environments. And, you know, our bones are healing and our digestion is happening. The pH is being balanced and our oxygen is being monitored, right? And there's a whole complex system that seems to work really well. Except in psychology. You know, there is this sense like, oh, now we have to get in there and do something. Like the system doesn't know how to heal itself when it comes somehow to the emotional issues. And it begs the question, why? Why is that? And we really think it's primarily iatrogenic. that is and a function in a way of let's go like in Rick Hansen's Buddha's Brain and others places, really pointing to the nature of the negativity bias. Just like you say, people come in and they say in a hundred different ways, I'm not okay, and here's how I'm not okay, and here's my suffering, and I need you to empathize with my suffering because somehow that's going to magically do it, or I'm going to talk about my trauma, and then we're going to process the trauma, and what process means nobody really knows in terms of actual biological function. And so one of the things that I learned from Rossi's work early on was about state-specific or state-dependent memory and learning. You know, just landing right there and being able to track and see the myriad of states. And I'll compare these states to something like the weather of a locale, you know, whereas personality might be the climate. And so when we're looking at something called organic intelligence, what we're supposing is that there is a healing, integrating, organizing impulse. And in fact, what I believe is that integrating impulse is more primary than any other impulse that's there. And it rides on the impulse of replication, procreation, on natural selection. It is a primary driver in the biology, because healing and recurrence of health, well-being, and expansion of capacity, it has selective advantage. So the nature of our self-organizing system, I think, can be catalyzed. And if we can recognize where those self-organizing signals are coming from that individual, then what I get to do is utilize those, right? The utilization technique or the utilization response of being with what is means I am disproportionately preferencing my attention to those elements from the person that are more organizing, that are more stabilizing, that are more helpful. You know, the magic question of the strategic therapist, you know, like, what if everything was okay? What would it look like then? And that's beginning to look at something about how our system's going to be self-organizing. And then I break it down into like specific channels of experience that I call ISOMA. It's an acronym for image, sensation, orientation, which is connecting to the environment through the senses, meaning, and affect. So there's the attention that is inward and then the attention that's outward. And what I suggest is, by practicing orientation as connecting to the exterior environment, you help the brain map the environment, and you're priming for what Porges calls this ventral vagal state. And that ventral vagal state is a more state associated with some of your topics, like curiosity and engagement and interest. You know?
And all these, so I just want to jump back to that lovely word that you used with familiarity, but we might expand a little bit, and that's the word catalyst. And you know, I've just been working on this stuff, writing about genetics for our book, and we talk about enzymes, which are catalysts all the time. Yep. And what nature does with a catalyst is it uses a catalyst to activate, promote, and encourage the process. But the catalyst doesn't do the process. Mm-hmm. And it's really important. And this is where therapists have, therapists have got that we're the ones that have to get them to do this process. No, it's quite the opposite. And it's exactly this facilitating, this generating something, and that beautiful acronym there you've used of the differentiated elements that you can utilize as a catalyst to shift your client out of the disruptive frame into a healing frame, because we've been doing it for quite a long time, I think, and without therapists.
Yes, yes, but we've trained therapists to in that medical model to it's not you as a person, as a being, are catalytic in the dyad. It's more with your intellect that we're going to teach you in this university course. You are going to, in a very linear way, apply these principles and these techniques.
Yes, correct the client's
which is
failings.
Very, very different to nurturing a catalyst.
Isn't it? And this sort of midwifery, you know, catalyst or synergism or alchemy or, you know, these ideas that there is a natural process that's ready and waiting, a seed that's simply waiting for the right conditions. And that's really it, that we create the conditions in which the biology recognizes, this is the time and the place for its natural unfolding. And that's classic systems thinking. Like, we're just creating the context. Context is really everything. We're creating the environment, the social, the personal, the interpersonal, the states of the individual that create then this environment that catalyzes then the self-organization process. And so, it's a dictum really that says, under the right conditions, our system will be self-organizing. And we just help create those conditions and recognize those conditions and refine our reflections. And it's really little more than reflections. That to see in each of these channels, what is organizing? What is the thought that is more organizing? But because, frankly, among all of those isoma channels, the biology has another agenda, and that agenda, of course, is the status quo. If you have a stable system, that system is self-reinforcing, and it's going to want to stay stable. And so if you're going to try to change a system or help a system catalyze, you first have to really buy into and ally with its impulse of stability or the status quo. And that means that among those isoma channels, image sensation, orientation, meaning and affect, most of the information coming from those is the self-reinforcing information of the status quo. Like, don't change, because the biology doesn't really distinguish well between, a change that's going to be growth-producing and a change that's going to be fatal, right? A system that disintegrates is a system that might not restabilize and completely disintegrate. So we look for and we expect, one, that most of the signals from the echo chamber of my self-reinforcement, the images, the sensations, the meanings, the affect, that those will be sending signals of SOS, same old situation. And that same old situation then means that there will also be some information coming that will be disproportionately organizing. And I feel like my job is, as the midwife, is to be primed and expectant to see when the labor begins, when the emergence of something different begins to happen. And that can come in an image, it could come in a sensation. And we could begin to see, for instance, it won't be possible for your audio channel to see this, but when, say, the eyes are working in concert with the neck and head, or when the eyes are moving in contradistinction. That is, when there is, as we were talking earlier, when there is harmony and when there is disharmony, when there is integration and when there is a lack of integration. And what I think we can look to as guidance for that, and you named it in our prior conversation, is intensity. That the higher the intensity, the less likely is it that the systems are going to work well together. In an emergency situation, say in a tribal situation, in a group situation, you know, if the house catches on fire, it's like, okay, son, call the fire department. Daughter, you get the water, and get the hot dogs, and you know, we're all doing something different. But then we come back together when there's not an emergency, and so our systems can do that. We can separate that normal link up between, say, heart rate and respiration, so that then we can go do different things, and then we come back together. But my contention is that the systems that are suffering, that are desynced, that are desynced by high arousal from trauma, from the condition of, you know, being out of our native sort of hunter-gatherer context, and that there are conditions that encourage and that show us signs of a system wanting to come back together. And so that's what we're looking at. You wrote a book, you know, on I haven't seen it. I just discovered it as we were looking at this podcast about hands and what the hands are saying. And there are mudras that emerge, you know, all the time. There are these things that psychologists will call them self-soothing, but they really don't register. They're there. They are these, you know, there are these gifts, you know, that are reaching out to us, you know, but unreceived. And so, and that's an example of a self-supporting, self-organizing signal that's coming through all the time, and in this case, coming through sensation.
Right. And this aspect of discovering the magic things. Ernie Ross has been using the mirroring hands, but we've been doing that for a long time. Hands are a very useful tool. They're very useful for giving you a symbol of differentiation. But when I give my workshops on it, I go back and it was wonderful. I was actually in a couple of museums as I traveled around, and I just took pictures of all the statues and carvings and things that have been going right back to the Egyptians. I'm saying it would be really nice if we stop taking ownership of these realizations we have. And Ernie gives the funny story of he uses one where he has the hand raised with the palm out and the other hand sort of flat down below. And he said that was a sort of a pushing away and a receiving process that he found wonderful. Went to China and saw a picture of the Buddha with his hands up, and it was his, and he's saying, "Well, he stole my idea, didn't he?" and, you know, with beautiful tongue in cheek, and I think this is why I like the term organic intelligence, because you know we've got academic intelligence, you know, intellectual intelligence, we even emotional intelligence has sort of been taken on as some kind of controlling mechanism of our stuff, but everything that you seem to do is this sense of flow, and just using the term organic gives you that feel of dynamic and that feel of this guy isn't trying to own my organics, because there isn't one, they're a big broad thing. But using that as a framework, you've developed a number of programs. Now, are these programs that you've done? Tell us a bit about those. Who are they for? And what, you know, what's been the purpose and the benefit of those?
Thank you for asking. You know, I just to touch on this, but the arc of development, you know, that we teach, like we do a what's called the end of trauma course, and it's a 10-week course, and then there are daily meditations, pre-recorded meditations every day to really help people access certain states and rhythmic experience in all of this, because it really is all about the confluence of oscillatory process and the physiology, and then educational pieces, workbook, and so that's for people to get a taste of how the biology can move from a conditioning that's bent toward intensity, you know, and then so negative reinforcement, negativity bias, and how the hijacked attention is looking always for what's wrong, how the amygdala, you know, when it continues to fire, is sending signals of danger and smoke and fire when there is none. And so negative reinforcement, just to remind us of that, it's been a while since we took Psych 101, negative reinforcement simply means the ceasing of a negative state. An aversive state that then is ceased reinforces what just happened. You know, so in the laboratory of Watson, the rats were introduced onto metal plates, and there was a subtle electrical current, and then they bumped into the switch, turned off the electricity. And then they went in again, and the rats learned quickly to go over to that switch, so that eventually they would run right over, turn off the switch, and the electricity. So it'd be, ah. So there's aversive experience, and then, ah. And for us, though, for humans, I believe that creates this very challenging conditioning scenario in which that says to us the way to feel better is by feeling worse first. negative reinforcement gives us this message somehow that the way to feel better is by feeling worse first. And so that's a bit of a challenge for those of us who, you know, were trained therapeutically, because the first thing we ask people, mostly, maybe not in solution-oriented work, but what do you want to work on today? Or basically, what's your problem? And immediately, by state specificity, you are evoking adverse states. And so in the arc of our development, we're helping people shift from that addiction to intensity and negativity bias into a more completely positive reinforcement frame. And in that positive reinforcement frame, we begin to learn the sense of release and of safety and of not having to control my experience as my system becomes more organized and as my attention comes into the environment and gives my brainstem this message of what Porges called neuroception, this neuroception of safety. So when my brain is mapping the current environment and things are okay enough, no existential threat, I get a sense of safety, and I learn somehow that maybe I don't have to be busy all the time controlling my states, controlling my experience, and so on. It's important to learn control, but the direction I think we're talking about here is coming out of a legacy of control. Coming out of a kind of colonialism of the psyche, where we're saying, oh, we have a better way, and we're going to show you what that is. And in the meantime, we're going to teach you to control your instincts and so on. But instead, to allow for the intelligent selection of an environment that really is wholesome and catalyzing of one's innate intelligence. And then learning how to let go into that. And that's a three-phase model, and Rossi pointed that out, you know, the Langton's egg and the three phases of chaos and then complexity and then self-organization. And those mirror, actually, the three phases that Evelyn Underhill pointed out in her book Mysticism. So there is illumination, purgation, and union, or Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma, right? These three archetypal forces of chaos, and then maintenance, and then creativity. So these are just basic forms that we're working through. And in organic intelligence, our programs, like the End of Trauma course, help people move from chaos into greater complexity and resilience, but then on into sort of what we call the, you know, what's popular more now, which is this post-traumatic growth. And for us, that means a self-organizing, auto-organizing biology.
And I mean, all this is beautiful. I mean, I love the way you described that these same principles are occurring in several different philosophies and approaches, which when you think in systems, you just go, oh, yeah, that's just an organizing principle. But when you think in a linear fashion, what you go is, what are they stealing each other's ideas, or who's got the better one, or which one works better? And this is where systems think, or thinking in the system, as I call it, is releasing from a lot of these confusions. And the other thing that really stands out for me is this lovely one you're saying about this constant intensifying. Putting it simplistically, might I suggest that this is something that we manifest sort of culturally as worry. I mean, worry is that thing that you can do when there's nothing to do, and then when it doesn't work out, you get this false relief, which is also what you're talking about. So it's kind of cut out the middleman. And we'll always have difficulties, and we always will manage them. I know you're not saying that you do these things and suddenly you're free of... I mean, we have difficulties three times a day when we suddenly feel hungry. You know, we've got to get up and go and get some food. Yeah. But to just get in touch with these frameworks so that we waste less time with what the external expectations, is this the thing that we've done so badly?
It's true. Or we also are pretty busy maintaining our threshold levels. I talk a lot about how we have this kind of set point, and in a way, the essence of organic intelligence is that we have a certain amount of intensity that the biology can process automatically. And that's you know, window of tolerance, you know, is something that we call, or the range of affect regulation. But what I'm suggesting is that this self-organizing process, when we have an intensity that rises to and only up to a kind of organic threshold, grows that window of tolerance and grows the capacity of how much the biology can process on its own, its bandwidth.
Okay.
How much intensity can the system process innately? And so when I grow those thresholds, when that system learns and grows thresholds, then it has an intrinsic and innate ability to process all kinds of intensity, so that then, you know, the feeling that used to be uncomfortable suddenly is below threshold and it becomes interesting. So now grief becomes enlivening, and ecstasy is no longer something that I can't deal with, but joy becomes available instead of sending me into a funk, or the anger then becomes like an energizing instead of, you know, bringing me to collapse into tears or something.
So these programs are helping people move what Ernie and now I call, you know, moving beyond the growing edge, allowing yourself to expand into the unknown, and what I'm now calling possibility.
Just on a very practical level, Steve. So end of trauma course, you're training trainers, is this a course directly for people that have experienced trauma and they want to, you know, grow themselves?
It is. You know, the end of trauma course is a 10-week course that people take over and over again, you know, because it changes you the next time, you know, you don't step into the same river twice.
Sure.
And so people take it 6-7 times. People have it for a lifetime. But that is a part of our coaching training also. So you take the end of trauma course, and then in 2021, we're going to offer a coaching course in organic intelligence. And there is the end of trauma course, and then there is Heart at Home, which is our online coaching course. Maybe the most accessible or easy access to find out more about this will be our PTSD course. And the PTSD in this case stands for post-trauma system development.
Oh, okay.
Where you discover possibility.
Yeah, there's post-traumatic growth and possibility. Right. Yeah, lovely.
And so I'll get you a discount code so your members can get a discount on that PTSD course.
Okay. Well, wonderful.
We'll push it around with them. Yeah.
We'll be sure to put a link in the show notes for that one.
Thank you so much. Yeah. That's a 6 webinar series, and I use clinical vignettes. So there are films also of sessions, so you get to see exactly what this looks like. And I just imagine, but believe that I know, you're going to so recognize the languaging and the rhythm and just the movement. I think it'll be an interesting and fun adventure.
Yeah, what can I say? I wrote the book.
Right?
No, I wrote a book. But our naturalness and our organic interrelated selves created all the stuff that is now that people have put in books. Nobody invented arrhythmic patterns. We noticed them, and I love what you're talking about in the way in which you're utilizing and engaging people with them. But so we're kind of at a point where we'd like to leave, although I know there's lots more to say. But is there just a round off, or have we rounded off nicely? Or is there something you'd just like to leave as a parting awareness?
Yeah, you know, I would just say that the practice I would institute, and this is a practice not of control but of allowance, and I think that's really key. And that is, and if we have 30 seconds to just practice this right now, if you're driving, obviously, you know, don't do anything unsafe.
Yes.
But or operating heavy machinery.
Yeah.
But that would be to take a moment and not do anything except let the eyes go where they want to go. Just let the eyes tour about your space and just let them see what they see, and stay in the seeing channel as much as you can. This is orientation, connecting to the environment, and just letting the eyes free to explore. and see what they see. That's it. Yeah, just nice and easy like that. And then we see, you know, if there is a shift of one state that happens just by letting ourselves come back to our senses just for a moment. And that's a really practical thing that people can do just for 10 seconds, just to take a little break and let the eyes roam a little bit, or pay attention to the sounds for a moment. Some connecting to the environment through the senses, orientation.
And that's just such a beautiful little physical demonstration or experiential demonstration of the catalyst stimulating the natural processes that are there waiting to be given the opportunity and the circumstances to do so. Because I know there were two or three particular things that are, and listen to my voice now, which has just had a shift. What a beautiful little exercise, Matt. Just so,
yeah,
so incredible. There's obviously a lot to be gained in looking at these materials.
Absolutely. Well, Steve, thank you so much for giving up your time and coming to talk to us here. It's been wonderful.
It's such a gift to me. It's a pleasure, and I look forward to this being just the first of ongoing conversations as we carry on forward and try to serve the children of this planet.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I look forward to lots and lots in the future.
Okay, thank you so much. See you later.
It's a pleasure. See you.
Bye, Steve.
Bye bye.
I'm still just sort of enjoying my eye wander around the room. Wasn't that just such a simple pause? And this is the thing of the Altradian pause, just give the opportunity.
Yeah. I tell you, listening to Stephen, it's like listening to you, Richard. All of the same the same things, and there's a lot to unpack in all of that, so I have to go away and have another listen and unpack all of that for myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, complex systems were catalysts, you know, bringing the right context and environment. I love that metaphor of a seed just waiting for the right conditions.
Yeah. I mean, these are all these terminologies that somebody's been using, but it's always a bit of a bad rap that, you know, complex systems, because it gets confused with the word complicated.
Right.
And actually, complex systems are even simpler than linear systems in many respects because of these organizing principles. But anyway, we've talked about that, and there's other things. And, you know, have a listen, go back.
Yeah.
And whenever you're feeling just a little bit, maybe it's not a massive exercise. It's just pause and let your eyes wander for a moment or two. I love that exercise. And we'll catch up with Stephen. Hopefully we'll get an article from him. We'll do a whole bunch of really good things.
Absolutely. And, you know, check out his website. Links will be in the show notes. So check him out. Check out the course material that he's got there. A lot of value there. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. It's been wonderful, as always, Richard.
Yes, indeed. And we'll get on and see what amazing things expand for us after listening to this conversation.
Okay. We'll see you all later. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.